Today, we're going to be talking about Vilfredo Pareto, one of the founders of elite theory. We are specifically talking about his sociological ideas and his political ideas, or his contributions to political science, rather than his economic work. Pareto was both. He was a bit of a polymath. He was both a worldwide famous economist and a sociologist as well. Today, I'm going to be focusing on the ideas around the elites in his massive book, The Mind and Society. This is what Pareto looked like. And if you watch my video on Mosca, if you haven't watched it yet, I would suggest you go back and watch it. Pareto was working around the same time as Mosca. And if some of these ideas sound familiar, they were covering very similar ideas at the same time. And it has to be said that they didn't get on. Mosca thought that Pareto was ripping him off and accused him as such, a bit of an old academic fisticuffs. And Pareto denied this, saying that actually, Mosca was just stating the obvious. And, you know, he came up with, the idea of elite theory all by himself in The Mind and Society. Who knows what it is? It's often the case historically that two people come up with the same idea at the same time, but this caused animus between the two men, and they never got on. Also, Mosca sided with the liberals in the Italian parliament, and before he died, Pareto sided with Mussolini and the fascists, and therefore they didn't get on the political front either. But anyway, let us get on to the core ideas, regardless of the personal preferences and squabbles of Pareto and Mosca. His first point is much the same as Mosca's starting point, which is that elites always rule. In every society, regardless of the official ideology, regardless of the system, whether it's a theocracy, whether you call it socialism, whether it's a liberal democracy, a monarchy, elites always rule. Every society is organized by a small minority, known as the organized minority, and Pareto treats this not as a moral failing, but as an empirical fact of social life. And much like Mosca, much like Machiavelli before him, Pareto wanted to write as men are, not as they ought to be. He was a realist, and he wanted to treat the topic in a scientific manner. Pareto saw himself doing science, capital S, capital D, doing science, in much the same way that economists treat the economy as a topic for scientific exploration and description. Pareto wanted to do the same thing and take some of those same tools and apply it to the world of power and politics. And if you actually look at The Mind and Society, it's a much bigger work than simply his political ideas. He has this whole system of what he calls derivations and sentiments. He developed an entire theory of human behavior. So Pareto's is very much an advanced sociological and complete system, which explains not only power and politics, but also various other things that go on in a society. And that is the context for all of his insights into elite theory, is this big book, Mind and Society. One of the big differences between Mosca and Pareto is that Pareto starts to break down different types of elites. And again, you must understand his breaking down of different types of elites in terms of his wider sociological model, where he actually says, not only are there different types of elites, there are different types of people. He has these this idea called sentiments, that you can get certain types of people. Some people are more prone to taking risks. Other people are much more risk averse. Some people are all right with change. Other people are much more adverse to change. And nothing accounts for these other than your natural predilections, something innate in you. So one thing to understand is that Pareto's Mind and Society does assert a kind of essentialism if you're familiar with that term, at the level of the individual in society. Certain types of people are much more prone to be savers. Other types of people are much more prone to be entrepreneurial. An entrepreneur is a certain type of person. They like risk. They like change. They're a bit fast. Whereas the saver, you know, is they don't like change. They're slower. They're more conservative. And these basic types coalesce into what he calls type one and type two elites, or lions and foxes. The lions, that's your saver. That's your person who is happy to use force, who wants a slower rate of change or no change at all, does not like change. Whereas your fox tends towards your entrepreneurial type. They tend to be more intellectual. They tend to be all right with change and risk-taking and things like that. So these are your foxes and lions. And what Pareto says is that all throughout history, these types tend to predominate in the elite class, whereby you either get a lion regime or a fox regime. Foxes rule through force, tradition, and conservatism. They value loyalty, hierarchy, and stability above all else, whereas foxes rule through cunning, persuasion, and adaptability. They innovate, negotiate, and manipulate rather than use direct force or coerce. Another way of putting this is masters in coercion is the lions, and masters in persuasion is the foxes. Foxes much more liable to, you know, use media manipulation tactics or soft power or other propaganda techniques, whereas lions much more likely to go in there with a truncheon or a gun. And you see these all the way through history. You also see regimes turn from one to the other. There's a very interesting study done on the Soviet Union after Lenin died, where the chief argument is that the Soviet Union under Stalin became a lion regime, whereas it had been a fox regime, and various purges by Stalin actually was a clearing out of the foxes and a replacement of those foxes with people of the lion type. People of the lion type, to use Spengler's terminology, if you watch my lecture on Spengler last week, you'll know what I'm talking about. If you haven't, I recommend you go back to that so you know what I'm talking about here, where he talks about the first estate, the second estate, the third estate, and so on. Lions tend towards the aristocrat are a lion type, and the peasant is a lion type. In Spengler's terms, so in the four classical castes, the merchant, the priest, the warrior, and the aristocrat and the peasant, the warrior and the peasant tend towards the lion, whereas the foxes are your intellectuals or priests. The priestly class tend to be foxes, and also the merchant class tend to be foxes, and they can actually buddy up in all sorts of different ways, the caste. You can have a period in time where ostensibly it's a lion elite, but it's underpinned by the priestly class. Okay, so you've got an alliance of, you've got some foxes in there, but it's mainly a lion elite. You can have it the where you get both of the, I mean, I would argue that at the moment we have an alliance of intellectuals and merchants in our ruling class. So we have a double fox. We have got a very foxy regime, or we have done for most of our lives. But these can, you know, mix and match in all sorts of different ways. A pure lion regime would be the alliance of the aristocrat or the warrior and the people or the peasantry, you know, or you could say the working class, the proletariat, who tend to have lionistic tendencies, according to Pareto. And what Pareto argues is that these two classes both have their strengths and their weaknesses. Lions have a very strong, stable society, but they are weak in innovation. They tend to lead to stagnation. They don't necessarily do that well in economic affairs. So you can have a very safe and stable society, but nothing really goes on, or, you know, it stagnates, or not a lot's happening really in the lion regime. Lions tend to come about when something needs to be sorted out using force. Something needs to be sorted out. Now, I think at the moment, you know, with the rise of populism and the general discontent of millions of people across the West, people are calling out for a lion-style elite to come. I think people in America hope that Donald Trump would be a lion. He is certainly closer to the lion archetype than we have been used to in the West. You know, he's been prepared to use force at different times. But yeah, typically they come to sort out some sort of problem, but their time in charge is not that long run, because the skills of the fox archetype tend to start to take over elite institutions. Good example from history is actually when the Mongols took over Persia, a miserable period in Iranian history when the Mongols came in. Now, they were obviously of the lion type. They were, you know, couldn't read or write, a lot of the Khans. They came in. They, you know, did quite a lot of rape and pillage and burnt things down. But when it was time to actually rule in the peacetime, they had to devolve a lot of power down to the vizier level. And they treated, you know, there are lots of tales of that time of the Mongols treating like the Persian advisors who were running the books and collecting the taxes and doing all of the managerial stuff. But they didn't treat them that well. You know, the story is that the Khan would be sitting there and he'd throw a piece of meat behind him, you know, and if the vizier was lucky, he might get some scraps, something like this. So this is how the Mongols were. But over time, the more and more control accrued to the domestic Persian foxes, and you can see what happened. And this, little story basically articulate what tends to happen over time if the lions have been in power for quite a while. The foxes have a habit, through their skills, through what is necessary to run a state, to take over. The problem is that the foxes, due to their aversion to using force, due to their belief in cunning and persuasion tactics and things like this, tend, if they've been in power too long themselves, to start believing in all sorts of utopian ideas, to be too idealistic, to not have a realistic grasp of some of the challenges in front of them, to believe that they can always weasel their way out of it. You know, this is where we talk about kicking the can down the road, right? What is kicking the can down the road? In pure Pareto elite theory terms, it is a fox elite refusing to deal with an actual problem and leaving it for someone else, using cunning, persuasion, adaptability, manipulation, negotiation, and so on and so forth. Now, they do have positives. It's not like the foxes are only bad, okay? The foxes are great at innovation. The foxes are quite good at creating prosperity, bringing the standard of living up. The trouble is that in those things that they breed, prosperity and innovation and new tech and things like this, they bring about the seeds of their own demise, because they lose sight of those things that are really important to maintain order in the first place, or they underrate some of these residues in sort of lionistic residues in society. They tend to be naive in the way that they treat different groups, for example. In the worst case, think of, modern, we need to be softer on the criminals and things like that, whereas the lion mindset wants to come down hard, crack down on, malcontents and criminals and things like that, using force. Whereas the fox, in a fox regime, these sorts of things start to become lax. Pareto talks about the creep of humanitarianism, okay, and lofty ideals and things like this. And eventually the foxes, through this sort of neglect of the basics, end up losing control, or they end up creating such a mess that the lions have to come in and stomp about a bit to restore order, until the foxes sneak in again and the whole process starts again. That is basically Pareto in a nutshell. He would probably say, looking at the West, state of the West today, that we're overdue a run of lions. I mean, if you look at it in the long durée, okay, there have been cycles of lions before. Napoleon was a lion. You know, the Mussolini and Hitler were lions. Franco was a lion. I mean, you know, if you look back in American history, Ulysses S. Grant was a lion. How do you know? He was a military man. Theodore Roosevelt was literally a man, was a man's man lion. Whereas somebody like Woodrow Wilson was a fox. And often it's really, really simple to tell, because you just look at the background of the person. You know, was this person a kind of scholar, an intellectual? Probably a fox. Were they a lawyer like Keir Starmer? Probably a fox. You know, did they come from the world of military affairs like many of those leaders I've just mentioned? Yes, probably a lion. Okay. And you can get hybrids as well. You know, there are people who are quite hard to place who are a hybrid. Somebody like Vladimir Putin or Chairman Xi in China today, they're probably a little bit of both. And actually, this is the ideal case for Pareto. He talks about something called social equilibrium. You can see his economic thinking coming into play. Well, you know, if there is equilibrium at the elite level and at the social level, you get the best of the foxes and the best of the lions working together. And that's actually an ideal scenario for Pareto. He also talks about circulation in and out of the elite. Now, you can see why Mosca thought that Pareto was ripping him off a little bit, because I talked about this already in yesterday's lecture when I talked about Mosca's belief in being able to bring people into the elite. Remember, Populist Illusion fans, right? There's my best-selling book, Populist Illusion. Mosca wanted there to be a route, whether it's an exam or something, from the bottom, you know, up into the upper echelons. And a healthy society, according to Mosca, you know, has a kind of open, it's an open elite as opposed to a closed elite. And Pareto also was very keen on this idea. However, to give Pareto his due, he had a much more developed and systematic theory of elite circulation, namely these lions and foxes that we were talking about, but also the dynamic of the elite continually drawing from vigorous new talents in the lower orders, in the lower strata, replacing those who've grown complacent. Pareto says that this is vital, that it's actually a sign of social vitality. It's not revolutionist, a steady renewal, so that an order does not become ossified, so that it doesn't stagnate, so that there is a dynamism there. You know, you can think of the, you know, you can think of it in any organization. If you have too many, if you have too many old dudes who've been there, and you know they're still running things like they were run 40 years ago, you know, this can in itself lead to a kind of turgid situation. So you need this cycle, ideally, but importantly, it's not just the replacement of the old with the young. It's also the replacement of, you know, people who were born into an elite with people who were born outside of that elite. Just like Mosca, Pareto, and just like Carlyle, Pareto wanted to see an aristocracy of the talents. He said it was dangerous if talented, intelligent, dynamic people were stuck down here, not able to progress anywhere. This is the sort of thing that ultimately does lead to revolutions. So, this is a very important idea. You know, elite circulation is actually a good thing, and a healthy society allows it. Whether our current society is allowing enough of this at the moment is an interesting question, because, you know, we live in an era where they tend to gatekeep these things more stringently than they may have done at other times. And there's a kind of compliance culture that has crept in, not just at universities, but at the business level. And there's a kind of orthodoxy. Okay, there's a cancel culture that has crept in. And I don't think Pareto would have seen this as a healthy sign. He would have seen it as a sign of an elite becoming more brittle and a society starting to ossify, because it's out of balance. It does not have that equilibrium of the different types of thinkers. And lots of studies have been done to show that this has been happening across the West. In fact, my buddy Eric Kaufman has lots of data on this, that across American universities, for example, in some departments, you have upwards of 97% of staff, you know, all being of the political left, voting Democrat. Okay, that is a level of I guess, Fox predominance that would be, you know, that is showing that things have gone out of whack, that something needs to come back into alignment. And Pareto would see this actually as a risk for the society. Blocked circulation eventually causes revolution. We're back to our open and closed elite. You get violent revolution and rupture when blocked talents replace the rulers. When you keep a lid on it, it will bubble up. And if the elite aren't careful, they'll create a situation where the lid has to blow at some point. That's when revolution takes place. And, you know, you can have a look at the 1979 Iranian Revolution, the 1917 Russian Revolution, the French Revolution would all be cases when something like this happened. Not only was there widespread popular discontent, but the elite had become corrupt. The elite could no longer serve. The elite had started to rule in their own narrow self-interest rather than for the good of the overall. Okay, that's a situation where revolution comes about. When an elite closes its ranks, when it hoards privilege, when it excludes capable outsiders, it grows decadent and brittle. The result is not gradual reform, but violent replacement, sudden rupture. Now, you could argue that across the West at the moment, the elite institutions are being asked a big question. There's huge, massive popular discontent among normal people, among the working classes. In this country, there is some violence that has started to happen at the time of recording. And the question being asked of the political system is, are you able to bring this in? Are you able to register some of this? Are you listening to this? Pareto would say if they were wise, they would actually bring some of those people in, accept some of that discontent into the system, bring it in. This is what I call containment all the time. And that would be a way of staving off an eventual revolution. Or they could keep on putting a lid on it, you know, trying to ban, fire anybody who talks out against the system, try to push it down, and eventually they will get overthrown. That is Pareto's theory. I've also talked about the residues and the derivations. It's worth just mentioning these are technical terms that Pareto himself uses. The residue is the deep, persistent, and non-rational, almost animal-level instinct, the true springs of human behavior. Examples include the instinct for combination, that is innovation, and the persistence of aggregates, that is tradition. So there's your foxes and lions right there. And then you get derivations, okay, which in the language of Jonathan Haidt is a post hoc rationalization of the residue. A derivation is a rational sounding justification that people construct after the fact, such as ideologies, religions even, moral arguments, political theories. These are derivations that come from the residue. So Pareto is actually a thinker after David Hume, who believed that reason is a slave to the passions. I have done work on this myself. In fact, some of my other books here, a lot of you will know me from Populist Delusion and Applied Elite Theory, but two of my previous books were pretty big on this. Shakespeare's Moral Compass, which applies Jonathan Haidt's model to Shakespeare, and also Shakespeare and Cognition, that takes behavioral economics, that's Daniel Kahneman, Thinking Fast and Slow, and also applies that to Shakespeare. I'm very interested in this idea, always have been. And Pareto is one of the people who got there first. Obviously, Hume was the very first, and you could even go back to some of the ancient Greeks who talked about this, but understanding that people are not rational. People, intuition comes first and reasoning follows. And where Pareto is innovating in a way is that he was saying, like, this is not only true at the individual level, it's true at a societal level as well. These derivations, these ideologies, these post hoc justifications for whatever we've done that you're coming up with, the actual root of them is something that's non-rational, something that's, something that comes before thinking. Okay, and in my various arguments and debates in the past, and I talk about this in Applied Elite Theory, if you want the essay, the way I formulated it, BS, BS, therefore we rule. That is the political formula. BS, BS, therefore we rule. This is the derivation from the initial residue, which is I want to stay in power. Okay, so Pareto gives a very powerful and different way of thinking about ideology. And where this is important is that it not only applies to political formulas, but to all sorts of justifications and ideologies that come out. For example, in this way of thinking, the doctrine of economic laissez-faire was a post hoc justification for the actions of the British Empire. It was one of the ruling ideologies that justified what the British Empire did. Pareto would argue that the residue was like, well, whatever it is those people wanted to do. Okay, the feeling, the intuition, well, Britain wants to stay on top. Why? Oh, free markets or something. Okay, and in this way of thinking, it's not that a bunch of the British ruling class, picked up Adam Smith one day and was like, oh, yes, I've really been persuaded. I've very much been persuaded of the efficacy of the market. It was rather they wanted to do what they were going to do, got Adam Smith off the shelf, said, oh, this guy seems to justify what we're saying. We'll go with him. And if you don't believe this happens, I would recommend spending a week watching various Trump apologists in real time today who actually generate post hoc justifications for what Donald Trump wants to do on a daily and weekly basis, and then forget the things that they've said almost a week later. There is the most kind of crude, in your face example of the residue and the derivation right here in the current news cycle. One of his famous quotations is, history is the graveyard of aristocracies. If you pull up Pareto, it's not long before you'll come across this quote. He says that eventually every elite decays and eventually every elite is displaced. No ruling class is permanent. Pareto's dictum captures the cyclical, unsentimental rhythm of history. Power is always temporary. Succession is always inevitable. At some point, every ruling class meets its end. There are also an interaction of economic and political elites. Now, I've already, in yesterday's lecture, I talked about Larry Fink meeting the Prime Minister of Britain and the president of the USA. This is obviously a like a kind of in-your-face interaction of the economic and the political elite. Wealth and political authority do not represent separate spheres. They reinforce one another in a complex, shifting cycle. Economic elites seek political protection. Political elites seek financial resources. This is your lobby money. This is, you know, your various boondoggles and kickbacks that go on. This is Boris Johnson working at the behest of construction companies who financed his campaign. And then construction companies getting a massive payday when Boris Johnson announced one of the largest housing programs in British history. That was a big kickback for his lobbyists, essentially. Pareto maps this interdependence as a recurring dynamic rather than a stable equilibrium. Now, there can be interesting scenarios when the wealthy elite and the political elite disalign or they start to go against each other. When you start to see the wealthy elite and the political elite start to go at each other, then things get interesting and probably you'll have some sort of civil war or some civil disorder. I don't think that's happening as things stand. I think the disjunction is between both of these elites and the people writ large in our current moment. But at different times in history, in different civil conflicts, the wealth elite and the political elite have actually been at loggerheads. And that usually results in one or the other of them being defeated. Then we get the core idea that democracy is a myth. You have symbolic participation with elections, referenda, public debate, which create the appearance of popular sovereignty without its substance. One of my favorite examples of this was actually in Stalin's Soviet Union, where they did have the Supreme Soviet and there were elected representatives who were nominated by the party, who then had to go down to Moscow for 2 weeks. And they also had Stalin called it power from below or something like this, where the workers would be encouraged to criticize the middle managers to, you know, they'd have a chance to have feedback against the, you know, foreman of the factory or their local commissar or something. And they had to sit there and take it. Okay. But now fast forward and think about our democracy. I mean, there's not a million miles between, that Punch and Judy show that Stalin put on of the workers having a go at the commissar while Stalin sits there and watches, knowing that nothing's going to dislodge him from power. And I don't know, BBC's Question Time. Is it just exactly the same function? It's exactly the same. The bankers, the bonuses, the bankers, the bonuses. Oh, yes, we've had our say. Congratulations. What a democracy. We've done it. Everybody knows that this is not actually popular sovereignty. You're not actually getting like the rule of the people. You're getting various placations and Punch and Judy shows to give the appearance of participation, which is what Question Time is. Question Time is also, interestingly, a manufacturing of consent. It is a chance for the system itself to program what you should be thinking. This is something that Peter Hitchens talked about many years ago when, on the issue of immigration, for example, they would put one anti-immigration voice, that would be Hitchens, against four pro-immigration voices. And then the audience would overwhelmingly boo the anti-immigration voice and wildly cheer the pro-immigration voice. Some comedian or celebrity or journalist or something, to adulation of the crowd, giving it the appearance that, it was about, only one in five people was an awful racist against immigration. Whereas in reality, the was the situation was exactly reversed. The vast majority of the British public have always been against immigration. This is probably the most easy example to show democracy not actually working in action and actually being a kind of stage show where you're giving the appearance of a discussion, but this discussion has been not only carefully curated, but curated in a way that is trying to push the person who watches it in a pro-regime direction. There's also the real decision-making, the actual policy, which is determined by competing elite factions operating behind institutional facades. And I've got lots of material on this channel about how this process actually works in the real world. In the way things have developed, typically it's an NGO or a think tank who writes a policy paper or a white paper, which is then presented through various back channels to the government, who then basically just implement that white paper. One of the most influential people who does this in modern day Britain is former Prime Minister Tony Blair. To the average man on the street, just the former Prime Minister, in reality, a massive power broker behind the scenes who has ghostwritten huge amounts of domestic and foreign policy for the past, well, ever since he left power. And I've already touched on mass manipulation, the elites employed derivations, ideological narratives, political formulas to secure popular consent for decisions they have already made. And speaking of Tony Blair, this was one of his specials. He would, the debate would take place on question time after the decision had already been made, after the law had already been passed. They love to do that. They love to have the debate after the vote has already happened. Something that, that's what I call the Tony Blair special. But this goes on in every democracy. Pretty much everybody watching this will know that this goes on. And yet it still works well enough for the bulk of people to actually believe that this myth, this obvious facade, is actually legitimately working. And as long as that happens, the regime still has some legitimacy. As long as some aspect, that enough people believing. Now, Pareto would say it's always false, that it is always a lie. But the important thing is not whether it's true or false. The important thing is whether people believe. Do they believe? The system has all sorts of clever techniques to make people believe. Oh, look who's read my look who's read my tweet. Look how many likes I got on Twitter. I'm really making a difference, guys. Oh, look, that question was asked on question time. Really making a difference. And this is how they get you. This is how you think of Al Pacino in Godfather 3. Just when I thought I was out, they bring me back in. It's that over and over and over again, years upon years, decades upon decades, even centuries, if the system is deft enough. Revolutions do not successfully overturn the elite triangle. From the front of this book, it does not. You still end up with new elites replacing old elites. You will never get rid of that structure. So, I just talked about Stalin's USSR. When the communist revolution happened, they did not replace the old czar, right? They did not eradicate the old hierarchy of the old czar. They simply replaced the czarist ruling class with a communist party. So instead of a czar, now you've got Stalin instead. But structurally, you can see it's basically the same. And so it is with every system. The new elite consolidates. It will have to sideline and discredit the old ruling class. It will have to do some sort of cultural vandalism to desecrate their memory, to establish their own legitimacy, and so on and so forth. Lots of that went on in the French Revolution. Huge amounts of it went on in the Russian Revolution, of course. In the Iranian revolution, every revolution must completely discredit the old system in order to build up legitimacy for itself. Pareto's point, though, is that all you're getting is a revolutionary vanguard replacing an old vanguard of the status quo. That's all a revolution is, in a nutshell. And finally, for Pareto, and this, I had a paper out earlier this year, which was called In Defense of Value-Free Analysis in a Woke-like Order of Knowledge. That was in the journal Theory and Society, which you can check out if you have access to academic databases. But Pareto was a firm defender in value-free analysis. As an economist, he maintained that sociology must be scientific. It must adopt a logico-experimental method, grounding claims in observable facts, testing hypotheses rigorously, stripping away moral or ideological bias. His treatise on general sociology, which is an abridgment of The Mind and Society, is a deliberate attempt to apply natural scientific standards to the study of society. No moralizing. Sociology describes what is, not what ought to be. No ideology. Theories must survive empirical scrutiny and not serve political programs. So that is the core ideas of Vilfredo Pareto in a nutshell. If you want to learn more, I talk quite a lot about Pareto. There's a whole chapter on him in Populist Delusion. Also, I expand on Pareto's ideas myself in Applied Elite Theory in numerous different essays. If you want to take my course on politics, it is Foundations of Politics. That's available at the Academic Agency. I also have a course on economics, the Trivium, Shakespeare, many other courses. You can actually get them all in one bundle, which is called the Ultra Bundle. I will play us out with that and have a nice day.
Ultra Bundle! 7 courses. Shakespeare! Research! The Trivium! Economics! Politics! The Ultra Bundle! Buy it now!
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just 3 of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.